I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Eric McGilvray, professor of political science at Ohio State University. We're discussing his recent book, Liberal Freedom, Pluralism, Polarization, and Politics, from Cambridge University Press. McGilvray works on modern and contemporary political thought with an emphasis on liberal, republican, and democratic theory and the pragmatic philosophical tradition, and he has published several books and articles on these topics. Okay, well, first of all, Eric McGilvray, thanks for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Eric, I love this book. It's a great defense of liberalism, a great articulation of a distinctive brand or type of liberalism that has two different kinds of freedom that's associated with it, Republican freedom and market freedom. I'm looking forward to the talking about the defense and the different types of freedom here. Can you start by just saying a little bit about what motivated you to write this book in the first place?
Sure. Yeah, there's really, I guess, two things I could say. Intellectually, I've sort of been interested in markets as a kind of interesting liminal space for thinking about questions of freedom and self-government. So markets are places where individuals make decisions and choices, but they don't make unconstrained choices. They're constrained, of course, by the limits of their own resources at any given time and constrained by the decisions that everybody else makes in the market over time, right? So markets are places of constraint, but of individual choice within those constraints. And then at a kind of macro level, markets are places where important decisions get made about social outcomes, but decisions that nobody really controls or can foresee. So they have this kind of interesting quality of being anonymous or impersonal decision-making mechanisms. And so they don't really fit, in my mind, cleanly into either of the categories of freedom that we think about, usually kind of unconstrained choice or self-government. And so I've always been interested in this kind of, again, this kind of middle ground space that markets hold. So I started that to swallow hard before I say this, but about 15 years ago, I started working on these questions and started to write what I thought was going to be this book, and ended up, much to my surprise, writing a kind of history of political thought book called The Invention of Market Freedom, which kind of took on the question of how, despite the kind of strange qualities of markets I just mentioned, markets came to be seen in the modern period. It's kind of like the paradigmatic place where you are free, which is a bit of an historical puzzle, because in the pre-modern period, as you know, markets were kind of paradigmatically sites of unfreedom. So I wanted to look at how that kind of ideological shift took place. So much to my surprise, I wrote a history of political thought book, which I hadn't intended or expected to do. And then, you know, about maybe 8 years ago, I turned to writing this book and to really apply what I learned about the history of freedom to contemporary political issues. So that's kind of the intellectual motivation. And then, you know, I don't know if you follow the news, Jeff, but like liberalism has been kind of under attack over the last, you know, let's say 6 or 8 years, both from the left and from the right. And I'm someone who believes that it's a matter of some urgency that the kind of core values and core practices of the liberal tradition be preserved and defended. And so the political motivation for writing the book is really to do that. And I found that the kind of conception of liberalism that we find in the academy especially is idiosyncratic and unfaithful, really, to what I think liberalism has traditionally stood for. There's really misunderstanding of what liberalism is abroad in the academy, to some extent in the public sphere. And so I wanted to really set out both to defend and also to recover a kind of understanding of liberalism that I think is really, again, urgently needed in our own political moment.
Yeah, good. And we'll circle back to some of the contemporary issues at the end. I was wondering maybe if you could just start by talking about your defense of liberalism and how it differs from the others that you just mentioned sort of in the academy. I mean, the John Rawls kind of contractualist version of liberalism still amazingly looms large. So how does it get, maybe you could just give us a kind of broad sketch about how your view of liberalism differs from the kind of standard model.
Yeah, probably the easiest way to get across is to start by saying that what is factually true, that liberalism as a kind of ideological label and an ideological tradition has its origins in the early 19th century, kind of in the years following the American and French revolutions. The first thinkers and political actors to call themselves liberal date from that period. And the kind of self-conscious liberal tradition of people who see themselves as sort of following and building on each other really starts in that moment. So it's people like Benjamin Constant, Alexis de Tocqueville, John Stuart Mill, the British so-called New Liberals, and others who are the true founders, and as I think of it, the true heart of the liberal tradition. And so a lot of what you hear about liberalism being understood as a philosophy of natural rights or pre-political rights, a philosophy centered on the social contract, as you just suggested by invoking Rawls, really misunderstands, I think, the kind of problem, the political problem and the political issues that liberalism set out to address and what the core of the liberal tradition is. So it's not, I don't want to say that it's wrong to call like early modern thinkers like Locke and Montesquieu and Kant and so on liberals, but I think we always have to keep in mind that that's a kind of retroactive move that you're finding ideas in those earlier thinkers that for whatever reason were seen as being related to or helpful to the thinkers who are so to speak the real liberals. Whenever you're recovering people in that way or retroactively labeling people in that way, you're probably to some extent distorting what they thought and maybe exaggerating the importance of their ideas. So when you start that way, Rawls looks like kind of like an idiosyncratic figure, really. Like Rawls, you know, liberalism is in Rawls's narrative kind of jumps from like Locke to Kant to him, right? Which is some pretty big jumps. And you really lose sight of this really rich tradition of liberal thought that has a lot to say about institutional design, economics, social and political psychology, and so on. And you really sort of thin out and again, kind of distort what liberalism is really about. So that's probably the easiest way to say how my way of understanding liberalism is different from what's in the academy is I really set aside social contract theory and focus more on this kind of complicated, engaged conception of freedom that these thinkers of the 19th to 20th centuries were developing.
Yeah, is it right to say that, I mean, your version of, is it maybe too simple, your version of liberalism is kind of consequentialist in the sense that your version of liberalism is grounded on kind of two different forms of freedom that are values that a, you know, liberal society should strive to balance and to maximize, whereas the sort of Lockean, Kantian, Rawlsian version of liberalism is deontological, I guess, in that kind of sense. It's kind of obsessed with rules and procedures, and so is sort of ill-equipped to work within a kind of modern dynamic society.
Yeah, I'm not sure I want to say it's consequentialist in the kind of technical, moral, philosophical sense, but it's pluralistic, right? So it's taking two values and trying to balance them with the understanding that there's never a kind of final, or at least as far as we can foresee, never a kind of final solution to the question of how they should be balanced. So it's kind of inherently pluralistic, inherently fallibilistic. Again, whether the question, one of the kind of artifacts of treating social contract theory as the centerpiece of liberalism is questions of deontology versus consequentialism come to seem central. And in a way, I'm trying to sidestep that question by putting this more this balancing exercise at the center of our attention instead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. So, and to turn the first chapter of the book, you start the book by arguing that freedom really should be understood as a feature of persons rather than of actions, which is a really interesting kind of claim, because I think you're right in sort of the way that, as you sketch it, a lot of the history tends to focus, and certainly in the kind of 20th century and the 21st century, focuses on how do we make actions more unconstrained or, maximize choice or... and that tends to be the focus of thinking about freedom. So your approach is to talk about personhood and the status, that you could be a free person versus an unfree person as a kind of social station, social and political station. So maybe to say a little bit about, that move, kind of why you make that move. I know you kind of work through in the chapter talking, kind of challenging the, Hobbesian and Lockean accounts of this. I mean, if you want to start there, that's perfectly fine. But why make this move, I guess?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, that is the kind of key move that I start with is distinguishing between freedom as a conception or a property of persons versus as a property of actions. And again, that's kind of an act of recovery. So traditionally in the history of political thought, freedom as a political value has been understood as a matter of kind of social status, right? So the paradigmatic example is, you know, one is free if one is a master as opposed to a slave, or one of a dominant class as opposed to one of a subordinate class. And then kind of corollary to that fundamental status distinction comes a kind of ethical expectation that by virtue of being free, or that by virtue of being free, one is kind of expected to or obliged to display certain ethical qualities, to be magnanimous, to be unconcerned with material things, to be courageous, and so on, right? So you see this sort of ethical use of the word freedom all over the place in ancient political thought and medieval early modern political thought. And some etymologists think that the notion of freedom as the absence of constraint is like parasitic on that more fundamental status-based notion, that we think of freedom as the absence of constraint because people who are free in that status-based sense were in fact able to do more things than people who are unfree. So that's been the politically interesting notion of freedom, that notion of freedom as a matter of social status throughout most of the history of political thought up until the modern period. This is the story that I tell in the invention of market freedom. The kind of key property of liberal freedom, as I think of it, is that there's sort of two social statuses that a person can hold that qualifies them as free, which kind of complement and also qualify each other. One is the status of free citizen. So to be free is to have a say in how collective decisions get made about how the polity should be run or what rules it should impose on itself and so on. So a kind of Republican conception of freedom. That's a privileged status, right? It's a privilege to be a citizen. And then the other kind of more idiosyncratic to liberalism notion of status is this notion of being free to act non-responsibly. So being free to act, to affect other people, to impose costs on other people in a way that you're not required to account for. And my understanding of a market is a social space where you're allowed to do that, where you're allowed to make decisions that affect other people without having to account to them, or without them having, within certain limits, any say over the matter. And that's, of course, a privileged status too, which we grant people for various reasons. And liberalism, as I think of it, is the kind of political project of trying to balance those two social statuses against making them available to the citizens of a liberal polity and then deciding what the limits of each of them should be.
Yeah, that's good. In one way, I think of the market freedom version as a little bit counterintuitive to you say like kind of, I don't know, people who call themselves classical liberals or libertarians, the idea that, you know, market freedom is in some sense about non-responsibility, because, at least those individuals would say something like, well, no, like classical liberalism, libertarianism, this view of freedom in the market is about personal responsibility. It's in fact, like that form of Republican freedom that you're talking about is the form of freedom in which we abandon responsibility to the state or to government, whereas market freedom is actually the form of freedom in which we're genuinely responsible. We make bad choices, we have to incur the costs, right? With Republican freedom, you can kind of shunt off the costs of your actions onto the collective. Help me, I guess, with that sort of what seems to be counterintuitive, and maybe like kind of deepen, say a little bit more about what you mean by responsibility, I guess, here.
Yeah, that's good. Let me try to talk that through. So I guess I'm thinking of responsibility kind of more in a relational sense. So my picture is that a market is a place where you have sort of like a menu of costs and benefits available. So a menu of potential actions available to you, each of which comes with costs and benefits attached. And you don't have any sort of unilateral say over what those costs and benefits are. And it's up to you to decide which costs and benefits to incur, which choice to make, and which consequences to accept or to risk or whatever the case may be. And in making that decision, you're right. You are responsible in the sense that you're the one who bears the costs and enjoys the benefits. But you're not required to account to anybody else for the decision that you make, or for the effect that decision has on other people. So if I make, and I should mention now, and you know this already having read the book, but for the audience, what I'm calling a market isn't necessarily even primarily a commercial market. It's any social space where you have this kind of non-responsibility. So it could be, you know, a marketplace of ideas. It could be a pattern of movement through the world, like a system, like a traffic system. It could be any domain in which people enjoy this kind of non-responsibility. So what I mean by non-responsibility is, in particular, that notion of not being obliged in a public sense to account to other people for what you've decided to do. Now, there may be all sorts of informal ways that, you know, if I make decisions that affect my friends or my family or my acquaintances, you know, they may, among the costs and benefits I may incur is their reaction to what I do. And if, insofar as what I do is sort of publicly seen, that's something I have to take into account before I act. But that's on me, whether sort of how I want to weigh those sorts of consequences.
I see.
Does that help?
Yeah. I mean, in a way, I was thinking about it in your book in terms of, you know, responsibility or accountability to the public in terms of particularly of coercion, because I was thinking about this in the context of, you know, I mean, right, market actors, you know, you just like take an average billionaire who does something sort of morally objectionable. But yet, you know, I mean, this is it's legally allowed. In that kind of example, I mean, yes, it's true that you know, kind of market actor is not held responsible in terms of legally responsible. But I would say that you know, there's a way in which we still do hold market actors responsible in the sense that they like are held up for public shame sometimes,
right,
or there's a kind of moral opprobrium that's attached to it. So do you mean in the context of like a kind of market freedom, you know, particularly, you know, form of political or legal responsibility?
That's right. So it, in a way, the fundamental question is a matter of like control versus non-control. So again, so-called private or non-public practices of shaming or praise, you know, praise and blame, these sorts of things have a profound effect on how we act, more profound in many ways than the actual legal constraints might have on us. And we all think about how we're going to look before we do things. But the key feature of a market in that kind of ethical sense is that nobody can say over time, or nobody's making an effort, a kind of collectively controlled effort to determine how those practices of private shaming and praising are going to turn out, what the overall ethical effect is going to be. So the idea of Republican freedom is that we're collectively intentionally trying to decide, to control what the outcome is going to be. Whereas in a market, that's left to the kind of individual decisions of, you know, individual actors, which are going to have an effect, right? There is, in any market, there is going to be an outcome that's decided, but it's not an outcome that anybody can foresee or control, especially over medium to long periods of time.
Yeah, I mean, your account reminds me a little bit of Hegel. So I don't know how much you know Hegel's philosophy of right. This is sort of, I always love doing this because it's like illustrating something clear by appealing to something super opaque.
Right.
But in any case, you know, Hegel has this view about public freedom in the context of the modern state that has kind of different forms or iterations of freedom that are connected with particular social and political stations, right? Certain functional roles that human beings can play. And mm-hmm. So he has two forms of freedom, like he also includes the freedom in the context of the family, which would be a third form for him. I don't know where that would fit for you, but, you know, he has this, you know, view of civil society in which, you know, human beings can be free in sort of this unorganized, unconstrained form, and then a form of political freedom in which there's a kind of organized institutional form of the state that provides certain kinds of authority. I think Hegel would be kind of, yes, congenial to your project. I don't know if you thought about his connection, but does that sound in the ballpark?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't, on live TV, I don't want to venture an interpretation of Hegel, probably.
Fair enough.
Especially with you, who knows Hegel much better than I do. You know, I guess my instinct is to say that Hegel has a kind of more, hierarchical or nested conception of how these forms of freedom fit together, whereas mine is more
right.
Horizontal and pluralistic. So Hegel's more, I mean, again, this is off the top of my head, is more inclined to have a kind of systematic story about how these things all fit together, whereas my story is messier and more contingent. And I think in that sense, maybe truer to the reality of politics.
Yeah, good. So can we, just to go back in terms of the, you know, kind of alternatives to your view, just so I'm, you know, clear about that. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, part of your first chapter and is sort of a critique of the forms of, you could say, negative and positive liberty that are associated with the tradition, say, kind of the view of Hobbes and a view of Locke, associating free liberty, say, with a, you know, absence of constraint on the one hand, or associating liberty with a kind of, you know, adherence to certain kind of rational standards, natural law, or you know, in Kant's case, certain kinds of, you know, rational standards as a form of liberty. You could just say a little bit about what, you know, I mean, those are views that I take it they're connected with actions rather than the sort of personhood here in your term. So what's the, you know, what are the main problems with those kinds of views, and why do you pick the alternative that you do?
Yeah, so I mean, you have to take them separately, I guess. So thinking of negative liberty, which is the kind of liberty is the absence of constraint, which is the view associated with Hobbes and utilitarians and you know, people like Isaiah Berlin, as people know. You know, the worry, and I've said this a couple of different ways already, is that human action is always constrained. And so to have a kind of intelligible theory of freedom where freedom consists of the absence of constraint and is a politically interesting value, then you have to tell some kind of story about what counts as a constraint or which constraints are freedom reducing. And those stories have always felt sort of ad hoc and philosophically unsatisfying to me. So for me, you could pick up a lot of what's interesting and attractive about the idea of negative liberty by shifting to this person-centered point of view, where the question is not whether we're unconstrained, but rather whether any collective effort is being made to define the forms of constraint that we face, that's Republican freedom, or on the other hand, we sort of impose constraints on each other through our private practices in a way that nobody's trying to make any intentional effort to control, which is what I call market freedom. So to me, that picks up the kind of open-endedness, flexibility that people find attractive in negative liberty without getting bogged down in what I think is kind of the conceptual problems of interpreting negative liberty strictly understood as a political value. So that's kind of one half of the story.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, because negative liberty often, you know, in the case of Hobbes, it's almost like, you know, anything can count as an obstacle to your will, right? I mean, even like physical things or, you know, gravity or something, restriction
right.
on me being free. So there's almost kind of an infinite number of things that I am actually, in fact, constrained from doing. And so then
And Hobbes's whole point in defining liberty in that way is to make it a politically understanding value. He doesn't think you can intelligibly resist the sovereign or do anything political in the name of freedom, because freedom is just sort of uninteresting property of physical objects that don't have other physical objects stopping them from moving. So that's one of the points I make, is that Hobbes in a way offers a reductio of negative liberty views very consciously, right, to kind of drain the language of freedom of this political salience, which he found, of course, dangerous.
Yeah, good. Yeah, and so the positive form of liberty.
Yeah, so positive liberty, if you want to call it, I mean, there's different ways of defining it, of course, but liberty and acting in accordance with a rational will or in accordance with principles of natural law, whatever the case may be. I mean, the worry there is that what freedom ends up meaning, or the value of freedom is it being subordinate to whatever value you've used to define what counts as rationality or what counts as natural law, and so on. So freedom ends up being not a political value in itself, but kind of a redescription in a way of these more fundamental moral principles of natural law, or whatever. And then when you start with principles of natural law, you're starting by supposing that you already have some kind of answer to certain fundamental moral questions. And that's what I think a liberal, as I understand it, liberalism wants to deny. So anytime you start with pre-political moral principles, you're enacting, or at least in imagination, in my view, a kind of a political exclusion, right, of those who don't accept the principles that you claim are rational or intelligible to all reasonable creatures. So I think you could pick up, again, a lot of the attractiveness of positive liberty by shifting to this person-centered conception where what we're trying to do in pursuing Republican freedom is create the social conditions under which we could be responsible for what we do, understanding that that's always going to be a kind of contested notion and that we all have to have some say over how those questions get decided. They can't be decided pre-politically, they have to be decided politically.
Yeah, so maybe you could say a little bit more about what the resistance to pre-political norms are. I guess, of course, the worry about sort of making all of these kinds of norms subject to political contestation is that it's, you know, has the kind of whiff of relativism, or, you know, you may imagine a kind of society in which Republican freedom decides that, you know, all kinds of kind of crazy things are the kinds of norms that, you know, we should abide by. I'm living in Texas right now, and so it's better go people's politics. I mean, you could pick your state, I suppose, but in any case, I mean, isn't it the advantage of, I guess, the liberal tradition and thinking about how liberalism does have some backstops in terms of pre-political norms, call them natural rights, human rights, whatever you want to do, that actually provides some kind of constraint on political self-determination?
Yeah, so that really gets at the heart of my critique of social contract theory. I mean, I guess my view in a nutshell is like, nice work if you can get it. So it would be nice if there were pre-political norms that we could all agree about, and that for that reason kind of consensually governed politics. But of course there aren't. All efforts to articulate norms like that, at least, or to give them any kind of substance, right? You can articulate them in name, you could say things like human rights, but what are those rights? How do we define them in hard cases? What are their limits and so on? Things quickly break down when you get to those matters of application. And so to my way of thinking in making that and trying to make that pre-political move of defining moral norms in advance of politics, again, you're almost always performing at least implicitly an act of political exclusion. You're saying, well, there's rights as I understand them. People who don't accept those rights as I understand them. And if I could, I would exclude those people from participating in politics because they have a wrong understanding of rights. And that, to my mind, puts liberalism in a way on the same plane as more authoritarian ideologies, which do the same sort of work in the name of different ideological ends. So I want to say, yeah, there's this kind of intuitive notion we have of creating the social conditions under which we could be held responsible for what we do that we can all recognize as a value, which has both a political angle and a kind of, anthropological angle. And this intuitive notion of being allowed to make one's own decisions without accounting for yourself. And what we're really doing in politics is trying to mark the boundaries between those two kinds of freedom. And you're right, I kind of bite the bullet on the question of whether there's any limits to where that could end up. I think in practice, there's a lot of gravitational weight of the status quo that's going to prevent things from getting too crazy too quickly, although maybe in things look different in Texas, I'm not sure. but even today, it's on people like you and me to get to be politically engaged and to articulate, you know, the values that we believe in and try to persuade our fellow citizens of why they're important. I suspect that a lot of, and this is really the political motivation of the book, a lot of the anger and extremism that we see in politics is the result of people feeling like they've been, you know, pre-politically excluded for holding incorrect ideological views rather than heard and taken seriously and respected for the views that they hold. And anybody who's made to feel that way, whatever their political orientation may be, I think has a tendency to run to the extremes and to do what they can to shut down the people who are trying to exclude them in that way. So I'm a little more hopeful about the kind of constructiveness of this notion of dialogue that liberalism commits us to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it does seem to me, I mean, you tell me if I'm wrong about that, but it sounds like there's a little bit of an element of kind of Rawlsian political, not metaphysical in your view. I'm not sure if there's a whiff of that in your view, but it seems to me like, so here, for example, I mean, you and I, if we kind of, yeah, right, run to the forum and could defend our sincerely held beliefs, presumably what we're appealing to is something like some kind of pre-political norms. Like, so citizens themselves are going to apply to pre-political norms, but like the governing principle of politics or the governing principle of liberalism is going to resist that, is going to try to appeal to some kind of political, not metaphysical form of overlapping consensus that, in your view, is going to have kind of these two different forms of freedom that people can kind of come to agree about rather than excluding them. Is that, you think you have a latent Rawlsianism?
You people are all the same. I don't
it's
think
amazing. I mean, I hear a criticism of Rawls and I rush to his defense, even though I don't like, I don't have any stake in this. I've written criticisms of Rawls myself. So
I don't think we ever have consensus in politics. So I guess I resist the notion of what we're up to consensus. I think that's it's mistaken. This is again my critique of contractarianism. It's mistaken to start, I think, from the expectation or belief that there could be consensus in politics, even a pretty abstract level. So I kind of end the book on this note in chapter 5. You know that You can think about so the idea of liberalism, as I think about it, is we're trying to strike a balance between these two kinds of freedom. We're never going to fully agree about where the balance should be struck, and what makes this kind of project something people are willing to commit themselves to is that whatever balance gets struck, at least you can see that there's a value on the other side, right? That you can understand the values in the name of which other people are acting. You disagree with them maybe very deeply about how they've struck the balance that they've struck, about the weight they've given or not given to market freedom or to Republican freedom. You may disagree very deeply about that. But you can see that they're acting in the names of values that you also accept as values. You can call that Rawlsian if you like. But so there's never going to be consensus, except maybe prospectively. This is the note that I kind of end on. Maybe I can believe that if I just had enough time, Jeff, I could persuade you that my way of striking the balance is the right way. If I had sufficient time and ingenuity and evidence or whatever, I could bring you around. And maybe we're acting in the name of some kind of hope for the future, right? The consensus might be achieved. I don't personally think about politics that way, but if it helps you to think about it that way, that kind of prospective notion of consensus, I'm willing to take on board. But the idea of a kind of retrospective consensus, I find it very implausible. I don't think we've ever had anything like that. And then politically, I find it kind of dangerous, actually, because again, I think it performs a kind of active exclusion against the so-called unreasonable, right? Mm-hmm. In advance of which I find kind of illiberal, actually.
Yeah. This is one of the things I found so exciting about your work. I mean, that in other words, it's developing a form of liberalism that is aware of the inherent tensions that exist within the tradition, that it doesn't seek right. to sort of overcome them through some appeal to public reason that's like unified and homogenous, right. but it's in fact affirms a contradiction in at the heart of liberalism, which both explains the constant conflicts we have, but also helps us sort of weather the dynamism and like enjoy the dynamism of liberal politics, right?
Right.
I mean, so that's I find that very interesting. I mean, my own stuff on liberalism is sort of I think this is where liberalism is to go, is sort of the awareness of the inherent tensions in it.
And you said developing it, but I also want to insist on recovering. You know, I mean, it's interesting if you really take the 19th and the first half of the 20th century as kind of the key period for liberalism, you don't find them talking about the questions that people like Rawls or Walker Kahn are talking about. They're not talking about pre-political rights. They're not talking about the social contract, except to dismiss it. They're not talking about, you know, human perfectibility, inevitable historical progress, all the kind of canards that get thrown against liberalism in the public sphere today are pretty much invisible during this period, and in figures like Constant and Tocqueville and Mill and so on. So I really want to insist that it's not just me developing something new, but me recovering something that I think is truer to liberalism as it was understood really up until the Cold War.
Good, yeah. So let's talk about Republican freedom, kind of drill down on that. In the second chapter, you talk about Republican freedom, form of freedom as a kind of self-government. You've already said, you know, we've been talking about kind of what it is. You talk a fair bit about Pettit, who's kind of the most famous contemporary Republican theorist. Could you say a little bit about how your understanding of Republicanism differs from that more kind of familiar Republican tradition?
Yeah, so this is really where I started, 15 plus years ago when I started thinking about markets is sort of how do markets fit into this neo-Republican story about non-domination, freedom is non-domination. And Pettit holds the view that, in his technical language, markets can vitiate our freedom, but they don't diminish our freedom. So, you know, I could be made poorer by a market or something like that, and that may reduce the number of things I'm able to do. But this doesn't count as domination for him because markets aren't intentional. No will is being is master over me if a market is controlling the outcome of my or determining the outcome of my life. And the kind of move that I make in chapter two, and a lot of people have kind of picked on Pettit for this point, but the way I pick on it is to say that even though markets themselves don't have a will or intention, they're not responsible, or should I say not responsibility, the decision to allow markets to determine social outcomes in a given domain is intentional, right? We make a political decision to allow markets to affect people's lives in certain ways. And, you know, that in a kind of second order way makes markets a kind of dominating force of people's lives. So then that starts to look like republicanism, strictly speaking, or kind of single-minded focus on republican freedom as the primary political value, is going to run into trouble, because it's hard to imagine having a modern society that isn't, where social outcomes aren't largely steered by markets. And for Republican, as far as I can see, who takes the position that, who recognizes that markets can be dominating, the only reason you would have to allow markets to exist is to kind of disperse power away from the state, that a command economy would be dominating. And so we should allow markets just as much authority over social outcomes as would not create more domination than it eliminates. And, you know, I want to argue that there's other reasons we have to value markets, other reasons we have to allow markets to determine social outcomes besides just dispersing power away from the state, although that is important. And that therefore republicanism taken on its own can't provide us with a kind of adequate account of freedom or the place of markets in a modern society.
Yeah, it's strange. I would have thought that the non-domination theory could be applied to the market domain, right? I mean, because it wouldn't, I mean, isn't this like Elizabeth Anderson type, you know, the sort of private authoritarianism type view of, you know, corporate life, that there's a kind of, you know, within business, it looks like an authoritarian structure. So, I mean, isn't that like a kind of application of, I mean, I don't think she appeals to Pettit, but it's something like a kind of non-domination view that's applied to markets. So while Pettit doesn't apply sort of Republican theory to markets, you know, others have, I guess I'm surprised he doesn't, but.
Yeah, well, if you're thinking about Anderson's private government book, I mean, she's really talking about freedom within the firm. So the kind of authority, the alarming authority sometimes that managers and bosses have over their employees, and how, for some reason, we don't recognize that as a form of unfreedom or a form of domination. So she's really trying to, very effectively, I think, actually, to call our attention to the kind of vast social space within which we're dominated by our employers, in ways that really aren't as politically salient as they should be. That's a little different from markets in the sense of non-responsibility, with sites of commerce, right, which are kind of inter-firm or inter-individual rather than within firms, if that makes sense.
I was wondering if you'd say a little bit about what's maybe this is a simple, naive question, but what's valuable about Republican freedom. You go on in chapter 3, we'll talk about it in a minute, about market freedom, and talk about the 16 reasons to value market freedom. I chuckle again. 16 reasons to value market freedom. But how many reasons are there to value Republican freedom?
Two. No, I don't know. I'm not sure. I mean, I think, you know, the kind of core idea of Republican freedom is this notion of having some control over your life. So whenever we're pushed around by institutions or forces or people that we don't control, that's really the heart of kind of the grievance that the idea of non-domination calls to our attention, right? When we feel dominated by people or by institutions, there's a sense in which we've lost control over our lives and therefore can't really be fully held responsible for the things that we do. Intuition that drives the value of Republican freedom is that intuition that I not only want to be able to do things, I want to be able to do things in a way that others will recognize me as having been responsible for what I did, right? I'm the one who did it. I get the praise and the blame for doing that. And that requires a kind of control. I jokingly said too, because the two things that requires is, on the one hand, that I have some say, right, over how the rules that govern my action get structured. So I take part in the democratic processes, let's say, by which the laws and regulations by which I'm governed are formed. But also I have to come to that process of, you know, political negotiation with certain resources, right? I have to be educated. I have to be not materially vulnerable. I have to be free of domination in my family, in my workplace, and so on, in a way that I can candidly say what I think and not worry about repercussions from people who are superior over to me in some way. So Republican freedom has these kind of two faces, right? One is preparing people to be responsible agents or creating the social and material conditions under which they can be held responsible, and then giving them this say over over the decisions through which their lives are going to be sort of shaped, decisions through which laws and so on are made. So that's the intuition, right? It's this notion of having control over your life and over the things that you do so that you can appear to others as a responsible agent. I think Pettit really writes beautifully about this.
I'm not sure if you know Bob Taylor's book, Exit Left. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. I mean, it's the general view is that, you know, there's a kind of tendency in Republican thinking, and it sounds maybe in yours, that to connect immediately kind of Republican non-domination with sort of democratic self-rule, that in the exit voice and loyalty kind of triumvirate, right, to really emphasize voice, whereas Bob emphasize, also points out that there's also an element of exit that, if a liberal state subsidizes exit for individuals to sort of leave their school district or to, leave their city, whatever, to move to somewhere else, that's actually, providing a kind of backstop to a form of non-domination and to a form of personal responsibility to govern your life as you see fit. I mean, where do you see that exit form as, fitting in within your system?
Yeah. So, I mean, the watchword of that book is resourcing exit, right? So exit is only a kind of meaningful check on power if people have a credible threat of exiting, and that requires resources. So he works through that in context of divorce, exiting a marriage, employment, exiting a job, and as you say, kind of exiting a political jurisdiction in a kind of federal political system. So that notion of resources, I mentioned this before, and Republican freedom is very important, right? One has to be resourced in a certain way to be able to participate effectively as a citizen and use your rights in a way that are going to be effective. Bob, like a lot of libertarian-leaning people, is very chary about the notion of collective decision-making and collective control over social outcomes, because he very reasonably worries that, like, the individual is really not going to have much say over the outcome that gets reached, and therefore it's not going to feel very much like freedom if all you have is sort of this kind of small input into a democratic process. That's going to feel just as alienating, maybe, as having a market decide what happens in your life. I feel the force of that worry. I'm not a libertarian myself, but that's, if you want to get into the 16 reasons for valuing market freedom, that's why I tend to see markets as a kind of essential complement to Republican freedom, because whatever self-government means, it's probably going to feel, under modern conditions, like a not fully satisfying domain to be involved in. And so you need some kind of safety valve, some kind of place where people can go in their lives where they're not responsible to other people or to the collectivity for what they do.
I see. Yeah,
that's in a way, that problem is what gave rise to liberalism, because once you generalize Republican freedom, once you have mass democracy, this is what Tocqueville and Mill are responding to, right? Political power then becomes difficult to control and difficult to avoid in a way that it wasn't for so-called free people, or not to the same extent, in the pre-modern period. So that democratic problem, that mass democracy problem, is new in the 19th century, and liberalism, among other things, is kind of born out of the response to that. The new set of challenges that development raises.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because the Republican form of freedom you develop is about accountability, responsibility to the public. And I guess maybe downstream of that is the sort of self-governing feature, democratic feature of it. Because I was thinking, the way Tocqueville and even Mill develops that sort of problem is to think about self-government more at local levels rather than at national levels, because at the national level it's just there's no genuine sense in which individuals can feel that they have actually a voice in what's going on. So would that be part of how do you think about Republican freedom as applied to national versus local? I guess that's the way to put it. Is there more Republican freedom at the local level rather than at the national level? Is that, or conceptually, or no?
It's a hard question. I mean, I'm attracted to federalism for the reason you say, and for the reason that Tocqueville and Mill were attracted to it, because the smaller the scale, the more the individual can have a kind of say. So the way I look at figures like Milan Tocqueville and other liberals in the 19th century is a wide strand in their thought, and sometimes an overlooked strand in their thought, like people who only read bills on liberty and don't read the considerations on representative government. You know, a lot of it is just sort of carrying on the work of Republican political thought that had been done throughout the early modern period and before, of kind of questions of institutional design, questions of, you know, civic virtue and how one develops people into effective citizens. A huge swath of what those thinkers were doing is just directly applied to those questions and trying to rethink them in a kind of under the conditions of modern politics. So another swath is sort of what do we do about individual liberty in a context of a social environment where, as I said before, political power is hard to control and hard to avoid? Do we need to have some other domain of life where politics is just sort of set aside, people can do as they please? But right, I think a lot of that is just kind of carrying on the Republican tradition that they inherited from people in the 17th, 18th centuries.
Yeah, good.
Does that answer your question?
I think so. I'm going to come back to it in a second. Sure. But the sort of local. Because I wanted to get on the, you know, get back to market freedom and sort of drill down, especially the, yeah, these 16, famous 16 reasons.
Are they famous? Oh, good. we'll make them famous.
We'll make them. Yeah, there you go. And I guess just as an interesting reminder, yeah, I think you said this earlier, but right, market freedom isn't just economic activity. It also can, you know, encompasses things we do in civil society or in the family, religion, et cetera. So it's got a broad swath. When thinking about, you know, the value of market freedom, it seemed to me in kind of going through, the justifications you developed, there's some kind of practical or pragmatic problems, I guess a set or suite of them that have to do with, you know, the kinds of, instability, costliness, unintended consequences, concentration of power, these sorts of things that are associated with sort of abandoning market freedom. I don't know if you want to kind of develop any of the sort of practical objections to, practical defenses of market freedom, I guess, to put it, just got to start there.
Yeah, I was afraid you were going to ask me to name all 16 reasons. No, grab the book off my shelf.
Number seven.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, there's 16. I break them up into four categories of four. And the first four aren't really distinctive to liberalism. They're just kind of practical limitations that one might face in a given society that you just don't have the capacity, for example, to regulate behavior in a certain domain, the administrative capacity or whatever. But the three kind of, if you like, value-based reasons for value market freedom, you know, the first set has to do with limiting political power, with the political price you would pay, both in terms of giving power to the state and creating or exacerbating underlying social conflicts if you try to regulate behavior too closely in a given domain. So that's one set of reasons. There's a set of reasons to do with sort of social benefits that arise from allowing market freedom. So innovation, efficiency, diversity, these sorts of things that can be created when you create these spaces of non-responsibility where people can kind of go their own way and pursue their own goods. Where often, again, we can't foresee what the outcome is going to be, but we know that in some form, creativity, innovation, open-endedness, and these sorts of values will be better realized if markets are permitted. And then the third set of value-based reasons is to do with individual development. So I can pursue my own good in my own way, as Mill said. We can avoid paternalism by not regulating people's behavior in a certain domain. We can avoid sending the message that they're not fit to make choices for themselves in a given domain. Or we can respect rights. So we may believe people just should be sovereign over their own lives in a given domain. And that it would be wrong as a matter of principle to regulate their behavior in that domain, say with regard to religion or something like that. So those are kind of the three boxes or three bins that I think of the value of market freedom is falling into. Again, kind of limiting political power or preventing social conflict first. Then kind of pursuing progress, innovation, creativity, second, and then respecting individual autonomy, third. And you can think of those as kind of the genres of liberal political thought, right? Different liberals put more weight on one or the other of those boxes.
Right. That's great. Get to your history in a second, but that was a really helpful bit. Yeah, good. So well, I guess first question on this, it seems that some of the benefits or the value of market freedom itself kind of already presupposes maybe Republican freedom already, or some kind of institutional structure or set of norms. I guess I'm sort of a Kantian when it comes to this, or maybe even a Lockean, that it requires liberty rather than license, right? This is, I guess, even Locke's point, that if you have license, you're not going to actually enjoy these benefits of market freedom, that it's actually going to be instability after all. I think you make this point that sort of Republican freedom kind of is already presupposed by market freedom, but maybe you could say a little bit about how is Republican freedom even presupposed in the value of market freedom itself, or makes possible its value?
Well, non-responsibility always has to be constrained, right? So a social space in which there is literally nobody responsible for anything would be, anarchy, and I'm not an anarchist in the kind of positive sense. So I think it would be, unsustainable, right? And situations where nobody is responsible for anything tend to be pretty unpleasant situations to be in. Whether the limits that are placed on non-responsibility are placed there by Republican means is an open question. You could have an authoritarian system that had, markets in my broad sense, in some sense that wouldn't be a liberal society. So liberalism is, a liberal polity is a polity in which there is a space for there are spaces of non-responsibility, but those spaces are constrained by rules and regulations of various kinds. And the shape of those rules and regulations, and therefore the extent of non-responsibility, is defined through some Republican process, through some process of democratic self-government. So it's super important what you say. Of course, markets are always embedded in some set of social and political institutions. Non-responsibility is always limited. But what makes that a liberal move is to say that the way the embedding is done through Republican means, through some process of self-government. And then again, the extent of non-responsibility, the form those rules and regulations take, and so on, that's all open-ended, right? This is the point you were worried about earlier. Mm-hmm. Where are the guardrails on this?
So maybe circling back to the local versus national point I made a second ago. I mean, it strikes me in thinking about the second and third set of values of market freedom, the sort of social benefits and individual benefits. It sort of introduces diversity and experimentalism and anti-paternalism and sovereignty of the individual. One of the things that occurs to me is that a lot of those kinds of values or benefits were precisely appealed to by, say, Tocqueville in the context of local self-government, also, right? So that is, aren't these also benefits of a form of Republican freedom? That is, that when localities take on, the activity of governing themselves, and they do, the different states and counties do this in all sorts of different ways, you get a form of experimentalism, and like the laboratory of the different kind of states in the United States introduced all these sorts of different ways of doing things. So is it, I mean, maybe, and maybe this is just sort of in, it's not surprising because Tocqueville's a liberal thinker who developed these kinds of things anyway, but that the benefits associated with market freedom here also can be applied to Republican freedom at a certain scale. I'm not convinced that it could happen at the national scale, but what do you think about that?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, so right, for Tocqueville, local government is beneficial both because it gives individuals more of an opportunity to participate in politics and therefore to kind of exercise their political muscles as citizens. And also, as you say, because it allows for more kind of pluralism in political decision making and maybe for jurisdictions to learn from each other and adopt best practices and so on. Again, for me, the key question is whether some collective decision at whatever level is being made about what rules should govern individual behavior, or whether that's being left to kind of the drift of private practices of decision making and praise and blame and so on. So that's I guess the cut point for me is once you have that collective decision being made, whether it's being made at a municipal level, a county level, state level, whatever, that's something different from leaving it up to individuals or voluntary associations or whatever to to decide. But it's interesting point you make that as you move down the scale of political organization, are you getting more market-like behavior or more market-like properties of the political system? I'd have to think more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've always been very, you know, I've always been animated by Tocqueville's vision of the soft despotism. I've always found that kind of compelling. And so when I think of defenses of liberalism, I want to see visions of liberalism that can kind of incorporate that kind of concern. I think yours does. I mean, maybe this is why I'm kind of pushing you on the national versus local, because I think that's kind of crucial to that distinction. But I mean, have you thought about the soft despotism worry in the context of your
absolutely theory? That's really the heart of chapter four in some ways, is again this the rise of mass democracy in the early 19th century in the wake of the French Revolution, you know, created in Tocqueville and Mill especially, but I think also to some extent to Constant and the liberals who came after Mill, this worry about public opinion, you know, social conformity, despotism of custom, all kinds of different names for it. And that's why they were so committed to kind of carving out social spaces of what I would call non-responsibility, where people are allowed or encouraged or urged to act in ways that they aren't accountable to public opinion or to the state for what they do. That you need these sort of sites, these social sites, where individual creativity, spontaneity, idiosyncrasy, and so on are cultivated. You know, for Tocqueville, those are voluntary associations paradigmatically. For Mill tends to think more about like geniuses and sort of extraordinary individuals who could set examples for the rest of us. But in either case, the concern is really kind of the same, exactly as you say. It's a sort of soft despotism of public opinion and custom and sort of conformity and so on that is really a new phenomenon in the 19th century. And I think one of the key phenomena that the early liberals were trying to take into account.
Yeah, good. So let's talk about your history chapter. You follow up the defense of market freedom and Republican freedom by doing a really helpful and interesting thing, which is to kind of sketch the history of modern liberalism, pointing out that the development of liberalism kind of precisely, you know, maps on to the emergence of these two different forms of freedom. Could you walk us through just, you know, sort of brief highlights there?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, again, the key point is that liberalism really starts in the early 19th century, not in the like late 17th century. So the first liberals are sort of these thinkers who follow the French Revolution, who see that really as a sea change in modern, you know, European political history. So I sort of tell the story as being two sequential but overlapping kind of developments. The first that we've already talked about is sort of democratization, not only of politics, but of social relations, what Tocqueville calls the equality of conditions that you find in modern societies, and he saw as a kind of inevitable trajectory that human societies were on toward the kind of decline of social hierarchies and the various kinds of inequality. And again, what Tocqueville and Constant and Mill and later liberals are all trying to come to terms with is the kind of transformation of social relations and the political challenges that raises, and that's their concern for, again, carving out these social spaces where people are free in the sort of sense of non-responsibility. And then also happening, of course, in the 19th century, which I guess we haven't talked about yet, is the rise of industrial capitalism, which is partly an effect of, like, you know, the breaking down of the old, you know, landed aristocracy and the kind of transformation of real property into commodity, and it's a sort of familiar story. And by the middle of the 19th century, roughly speaking, the kind of devastating effects that is having on ordinary people, on workers, especially, are starting to be felt. And this raises a concern in the mind of liberals and, of course, in the mind of many others of, you know, how can we expect people to be responsible citizens if in their private lives they're economically vulnerable, dominated by their employers, impoverished, in danger of eating tainted meat and being exposed to toxic chemicals and maimed in their jobs and so on, right? And so, you know, one of the great achievements of liberalism in the second half of the 19th century and the first half of the 20th century is the building of a kind of social and political infrastructure that tries to construct people as responsible citizens. You know, the building of a welfare state, the introduction of minimum wage, maximum hours laws, workplace safety laws, social insurance programs for disabled, elderly, unemployed, and so on. All of the sort of familiar suite of the kind of liberal welfare states is constructed by largely by liberal polities, liberal regimes in this period, in the name of, they don't always use the word, but they use recognizable terminology of republican freedom, of creating the conditions under which people can be held responsible for what they do. Because one of the things these liberals talk about, people like Mill, first of all, but also L.T. Hobhouse, J.A. Hobson, John Dewey, others, is how you see this phenomenon of people really just being pushed around by market forces, you know, being having their lives turned upside down by a change in fashion or the failure of a business or the invention of a new, more efficient way of making something that puts them out of work or whatever the case may be. Things we're still, of course, facing today. So this is a kind of second phase in the development of liberalism, where the early enthusiasm for market freedom is kind of qualified and corrected by this later consciousness that we need to put some guardrails on this to protect people from the vulnerability they're otherwise going to face if they're just at the mercy of markets.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I especially like appreciated the historical attention here, because it helps, I think, address certain, and I mean, we could turn to this, your final chapter on polarization. It sort of helps address longstanding criticisms of liberalism that tend to maybe flatten what liberalism is, right? You know, right. To identify liberalism, as it were, with neoliberalism, for example, and point out all the kinds of ways in which neoliberalism is implicated with capitalism and an empire and so forth. And from a more expansive liberal conception, one could say, yes, these are problems, but they're not problems with liberalism. They're problems with a particular way of narrowing liberalism. Maybe if you want to take up maybe that first, you know, the kind of challenge of to liberalism from the left. You have several pages in the chapter on its liberalism's connection with inequality and empire, and how, you know, how liberal can respond to that in your view.
That's a big question. I mean, capitalism is, you know, most liberal societies, I mean, I think that's all liberal societies, as far as I can see, are capitalist in some sense, but all liberal societies are also socialist in some sense, right? So this is a kind of version of the balancing exercise I've been talking about this whole time, right? That you have market freedom qua capitalism complemented by and corrected by a welfare state, you know, and so on, you know, qua socialism, and that's always been a balancing exercise. And you see liberals kind of wrestling with the question of what does it mean to be socialist in the late 19th century, and what kind of socialism can also be liberal? And so I spent some time on this in chapter 5 and also in chapter 4. So that's, again, it's to avoid two extremes, right? The kind of reducing liberalism to pro-capitalism, right, in the way that a neoliberal might, right? But also to avoid seeing socialism as a kind of alternative to liberalism, rather than as the kind of aspect or dimension of liberalism. And again, to take on what I see as the kind of distinctively liberal insight, which is that you're always balancing these two things against each other, and always correcting the balance that you've already struck in the face of new and maybe unforeseen problems that arise from the previous way you struck the balance. So that's the capitalism story. You've alluded now to the imperialism story, which of course is a kind of prominent strand of criticism of liberalism over the last couple decades, especially from the left. So the kind of coming to terms with the liberal legacy of imperialism and the role that important liberal thinkers, including all the ones that we've talked about here, their implication in European colonialism and imperialism over the course of the 19th and 20th centuries. And that's, you know, it's a really hard question. One of the corollaries of placing liberalism as I do in the 19th century is to reveal that liberalism comes along when European colonialism and imperialism is already well underway, right? This is already a hundreds of years long project of colonialism and imperialism. So the question liberals have to face, liberal thinkers like Tocqueville and Mill and so on have to face, is not, should we have an empire? But what do we do about the empire that we already have, which is a very different kind of question. And the thing I try to show in chapter 5 is that liberals are really all over the board on that question. There are liberals who say, as Constant said, you know, disengage from empire. Empire is always going to be corrupting of the liberal metropole. That the only form of engagement we should have between, or the most constructive form of engagement there should be between European and non-European societies, is one that's centered on commerce, that trade has a kind of liberalizing effect. Smith believed this very strongly, for example. But the kind of territorial imperialism is always bad for both parties and should be avoided. That's one position. The famous position, of course, is Mill's position, which is the kind of more, I call it the paternalistic position, right? Which is that liberal societies have a kind of duty to prepare colonized peoples for self-government, to kind of bring them along the civilizational path to the level that Europeans have reached, not if you've been aged particularly well. Tocqueville holds yet a third view, which is that imperialism can be a kind of site for building political solidarity and political virtue among the citizens of the liberal polity itself. So that he has a kind of heroic notion of imperialism, as I call it, right? That to combat kind of individualism and materialism he's worried about in modern democracies, you can have these kind of pursuit of glory through empire that would have a kind of elevating effect. Also, if you assign very well. And then in thinkers like the British New Liberals, like Hobhouse and Hobson, you really see the origins of what we would now call liberal internationalism, right? This notion that liberal democracies can promote liberal ideals through kind of international organizations in a way that would be neither entirely reliant on commerce, but nor would it be reliant on kind of traditional imperialism in the kind of territorial domination sense. So each of those views has kind of, you know, maybe attractions and pretty obvious shortcomings. But the kind of conclusion I reach in that chapter is that there is no liberal position on empire, that liberals are wrestling with the question of, again, what do we do about empire that already exists? What do we do about when liberal societies come into societies where there isn't self-government or democracy in the kind of way that Western liberals recognize? And those are really hard questions. And the questions that those thinkers are wrestling with are still the questions we wrestle with in liberal foreign policy today.
Yeah, I mean, if I understand the logic of it, you know, a liberal in your view would apply the same kind of dynamic tension at the level of the international, you know, the relation among nations, as it were, as one would do at the domestic level, so that there's always a tension in thinking about the relation between liberal states and, say, non-liberal states about, you know, how to relate. Should we relate in terms of a kind of, you know, mutuality in terms of mutual self-development, self-determination, try to move towards a common republican form of government, which has its own, which has some advantages but also pitfalls, or, you know, to sort of market freedom where each leaves one another kind of non-responsible to one another. I don't know if you thought about it in that sort of way, but when I read the chapter, it sort of, you know, trying to apply this thinking about liberalism to the global level was interesting.
That's a nice way of putting it. Yeah, I like that. I mean, the conclusion I kind of reached in chapter five, although it's not a very subtle conclusion because I haven't, global politics is not something I spent a lot of time thinking about in my career. But the conclusion I reach is that liberals can't just be indifferent when they find domination in other societies, right? There may be all kinds of prudential reasons or humanitarian reasons why they should leave that sort of thing be, but that the liberals are concerned about domination wherever they find it, and when they find other societies in which large portions of the population, women or the poor or the, you know, ethnic minorities, religious minorities, whatever, don't have a political say, that's a kind of standing problem from a liberal point of view. And then what you do about it is a very hard question. There's a number of different answers liberals are given to that question, none of which is entirely satisfying. But what you say about non-responsibility is interesting. I hadn't really thought about that. I'm not sure if liberals could take a non-responsible attitude toward political domination.
Yeah, well, if you,
when they find it in the world,
right? Well, it's hard. I mean, this is often a question. I mean, when you find domination in another country, do you take a kind of crusading attitude to reform that country, which could kind of smack of a kind of liberal imperialism, or do you, you know,
right,
allow a kind of non-responsibility where you allow the other country to develop in its own distinctive kind of way and hands off? And I take it that it's a similar kind of tension that would be at work, you know, that sounds to be at work at the domestic level.
I think that's right. I mean, it's a prudential question. It's a very hard question. And my own intuitions lie in the domain of being conscious of one's own fallibility and humble about one's own ability to do good in the world, and take into account unforeseen consequences and so on. So that's my own my own set of intuitions, but other liberals are more confident than me, I guess, for better or worse.
Good. Yeah. So let's finish by talking about, well, the polarization, to sort of circle back to that and kind of come up to the present in terms of, you know, contemporary political problems that that motivated you. You know, one of the focuses of chapter five is to make the case that, you know, the form of liberalism that you defend here recover is more promising in terms of addressing the worries about polarization that we see, say, in American politics, but also many, many other places. It's much more promising than, you know, say, a contractualist Rawlsian version of liberalism. Why do you think so?
Yeah, so one way to put it is to say that I'm, rather than conceiving of liberalism as a political ideal, as a kind of vision of a just society, whatever the case may be, as Rawls does, I'm thinking of liberalism as a political vocabulary. It's a language that we can use, that we can all kind of inhabit for talking about the political disagreements that we face. So as I said before, if we're trying to strike a balance between Republican and market freedom, we may profoundly disagree about how that balance has been struck in a given time and place. But as long as we can recognize both of the values that are in play as values, and in that sense, the position we disagree with is nevertheless intelligible to us, that to me is a much more constructive starting place for political engagement, much more respectful way of engaging with people who disagree with you than saying, no, right, I have the right answer. You're unreasonable for not sharing the answer that I have come to. Or even then thinking that, well, in principle, there must be a right answer that we could all identify, and the project has to be to start by finding what that answer is, and then by taking whatever steps we can to implement that blueprint, so to speak. So it's a more modest conception in the way of what politics can really do.
So what's your sense in terms of the long-term health of liberalism? Are you optimistic? You pessimistic? I mean, are we going to be more or less liberal in your sense in 10 years from now, say, for example? You get into your crystal ball here.
Yeah, I'd like to say that I was optimistic, but I'm not sure it's true. I mean, you know, I'm optimistic in the sense that if you look back over the history of the last couple of centuries, it just, the achievements that this modest conception of politics have reached are really extraordinary. What's happened since, let's say, the French Revolution, to take a kind of not quite arbitrary historical starting point, the advances that have been made on both dimensions of human freedom in that period are really extraordinary. And I think it's hard to avoid the conclusion, if you look at history carefully, that liberal societies really are the places where those advances were made, and that liberalism is, despite its kind of theoretical modesty, has a track record, a proven track record that far exceeds that of its ideological rivals. If you zoom out more historically, I think liberalism looks much more fragile and much more unusual. It's not something that's natural to human beings, and I think it's easy to take for granted the achievements of liberalism, and to forget how strange it is, in a way, that we have these islands in human history and islands in the world today where liberal values really are central to the way politics works. So I'm both grateful and proud, despite its checkered history and the many things that liberals have gotten wrong, some of which we talked about, some of which we haven't. I think it's a pretty good track record, and I think it's a story that's worth telling. And I think, again, this is one reason I want to engage in this active recovery of inviting people to see liberalism as a different kind of tradition than maybe academic liberals often portray it. But I'm also, you know, again, conscious that it's a quite a fragile achievement, and that it could all, you know, it could all go away. I wish I could say I'm entirely hopeful, but I'm actually quite concerned, which has been one of the reasons why I thought it was important to write this book.
Well, Eric McGilvary, thanks so much for this great conversation and for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Sorry to end on a dark note, but thanks. It was fun.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.